Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Spurs in full cry here.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm about to be joined by our friend and sports psychologist, Alex Stoyle. But before I speak to Alex, I wanted to remind you that during March, we are partnered with Pleaties. We're very happy to be partnered with Pleaties. They are a clothing brand, casual wear for Spurs fans. Their designs are inspired by the highs and lows of being proper coys. I love their designs. I think they're really cool. Really unusual, unique. You don't get Spurs gear like this. Go check them out, pleaties.com. The name is a David Pleat reference, so it is spelt PLEATEES.com. They've created a discount code, especially for the Extra Inch listeners. It is extra20, and that will get you 20% off. Give them a follow on Twitter as well, at Pleaties. Again, it's PLEATEES. Say hi. Tell them that you're a listener of The Extra Inch. I'm sure they'll be very glad to have you on board. And I'm very happy to welcome back friend of the podcast and sports psychologist, Alex Stoyle. Alex, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, Windy. How are you?
Very well. It's really nice to see you. It's been a while, and we always sort of collect a bunch of questions in the interim periods because people were so fascinated about sports psychology, and obviously you have a lot of expertise. In fact, if people haven't heard you speak before, perhaps you could remind them of your credentials.
Yeah, so I'm currently a trainee sports psychologist. So I have I'm currently doing a doctorate at the University of Portsmouth. My area of kind of specialty or area of research is around sort of choking under pressure or bottling it or Spursiness, depending on how you wanna label it. Yeah, and that's as part of a kind of a longer process of becoming a sort of fully signed up and qualified sports psychologist. And then I'm also a Spurs season ticket holder. So I am, qualified, I guess, on both sides to sort of talk
absolutely
about
sports psychology. And you worked in professional sport as well.
Yes. So, I have and worked with, across a number of different sports, a number of different sort of levels.
Both teams and individual athletes as well, I think it's important to say.
Yeah, exactly. And I really like that. It's one of the most kind of fun and fascinating bits of my sport is kind of working, you know, 1 minute you're working with a swimming team and then you're working with an individual golfer and then you're working with a rugby club and then you're working with rowing or whatever. Yeah. So it's really fun to kind of bounce around from different types of sports, team sports, individual sports, etc. So, yeah, it's really fun.
Amazing. It must keep you on your toes, I'm sure. So we've got loads to get through. I'd like to start off by talking about uncertainty and Chelsea's current situation, I think, is a a really sensible place to start. So what they're going through at the moment with the change in ownership and the uncertainty around the ownership of the club, how much money they might or might not be able to spend in the summer, whether they might be able to offer contracts to players, that any revenue can't be taken, etc. How might that impact on the sort of day-to-day, I was going to say the performance of players on the pitch, but it's more than that. It's the sort of day-to-day training. It's everything to do with being a player at a club going under that kind of stress and scrutiny and uncertainty.
Yeah, and I think uncertainty could be quite an important factor in that. Like there is definitely some sort of logic to why that might impact someone's mindset, which might in turn impact their performance. I think, you know, when I've been on before, I've spoken a bit about control, and control is really kind of the most, to me, is kind of the most fundamental concept sort of underpinning sports psychology. Like, focus on the things you can control, or at least that you can kind of influence. And when you have large amounts of uncertainty that are about things that are, in this case, totally beyond your control, that can be quite disconcerting, right? And so I guess if I was Chelsea's sports psychologist and was actually trying to help them, rather than a sort of trying to bring them down from within, then I would be kind of encouraging the players to focus on the things that they can still control, and to sort of, you know, distance themselves from any of those kind of what if scenarios and the uncertainty that comes through there. But on the other hand, I think there's also kind of other factors that come as a sort of direct result of some of that uncertainty. So, you know, things like, you know, the imposition of the kind of the travel costs and that being capped. I mean, it's capped at an amount that to most people feels absolutely, or certainly to me, feels kind of ludicrous. The idea that you can't travel, transport a team of, you know, however many players and however many support staff, for less than whatever it is, 50 grand or something, is kind of insane. But even things like that, right? I mean, if I talk a lot with sports people of kind of all levels, but particularly kind of younger ones who are still sort of, you know, in their late teens and are kind of maybe coming up on a kind of, you know, the crucial part of their career. I talk a lot about pre-competition routines or pre-performance routines, and how important that can be for trying to modulate your own sort of level of kind of excitement or anxiety, so that you find the sort of optimal level that's right for you, right? And that can be really different from one person to another. So the example I kind of often call on in that situation is, like, I have a little slide when I'm doing workshops, and it's got a photo of Michael Phelps before an Olympic final, and he looks like he's about to rip someone's head off. He's like grimacing and growling and frowning. And then a photo of Usain Bolt, and Usain Bolt is dancing behind the blocks. He's high-fiving the kid who's kind of going to take his clothes off, you know, whatever. He's shouting at the crowd, rallying them up, whatever. So, you know, two totally different outward kind of personas, two totally different ways to prepare. And yet these are two of the, you know, the best you've ever done it. You know, they're the best in their respective sports, you know, kind of all time. So it can work very differently for each person. But if you then start messing with that, and that pre-performance routine can start, it's not necessarily just minutes or even hours before the race, right? It can start long before that. And so if all of a sudden you've got players who are used to flying in lovely private jets with, you know, from here to there, and, you know, even flying sort of just around the country, right? It's not even the European matches, they're flying to the Midlands, you know, on a private jet. So all of a sudden, like, when that changes, and they might have to be, like, on a bus, or even if they're just flying, you know, first class but on a regular airplane, slumming it, you know, but that will still have an impact, right? Because they will have come to build their routines around certain aspects of that, and that those repercussions can just start to kind of, you know, cause little ripples, right? Of like, I didn't get to do the thing that I normally do, or my schedule's a little bit knocked off because normally we would have arrived by 7 p.m. so that we could get to the team hotel by here and eat by then, and blah 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 blah. You know, and instead you've got to do things slightly differently. So I think there are some slightly more kind of logistical things as well, which would then have that psychological impact. But ultimately, that uncertainty is something that could certainly creep in, right? And I think, the person who asked this question, Adam, was kind of saying, like, that it was, you know, maybe the financial concerns aren't as front of mind as they might be for, well, in the news today, right? And yesterday was the P&O story that P&O Ferries and Cruise Lines have just fired a whole bunch of people, and a bunch of them just like basically mutinied and refused to get off the boats. You know, so for there's probably a bit of a difference in terms of what the P&O personnel were earning compared to professional footballers at Chelsea. But still, you know, like no one wants to lose their job. No one wants to sort of not have a purpose, not have a thing to do tomorrow. And that's going to impact anyone. And I guess even to some extent, you know, like there is a there's going to be a huge difference between like your really, really top end earners at Chelsea compared to someone, you know, the kid who's just about to break through, who's kind of hasn't yet had a contract extension, etc. Like they, and you know, I can easily imagine that for professional footballers there's a little bit of a kind of at the beginning maybe people living beyond their means as well, of kind of like wanting to keep up, right? They turn up to training and everyone else has got a flash new Ferrari or whatever, and so they want to turn up with that, and maybe actually they're not in a position quite yet where that's a sensible decision. So for some of those, there may genuinely be, you know, and if you're being kind of a bit cynical or even sort of mean-hearted, you kind of go, well, nice problems to have when you can't afford your Ferrari. But, you know, still, like, people will be living on an expectation of making a certain amount of money. That's how almost everyone works, right? And you know, conceivably, some of them will be living pretty close to not making ends meet, as astonishing as that might sound. But, you know, for them, this would also carry that financial concern. That being said, I one of the things that really struck me with this question was that there's also the flip side of this question is a different question that I know kind of does the rounds. I think it's maybe been mentioned on the pod before, and I've definitely seen it on Spurs Twitter and all the rest of it, is almost the opposite, right? So this question's about like, does uncertainty cause, or could it cause worse performances? And then there are questions around, if a player signs a new contract, are they going to go off the boil? Are they going to become complacent and switch off and not be as good? And so to me, there's something quite interesting in that like people essentially kind of looking to almost pin bad performances on something, like a root cause, whether that's too much security or too little, too much uncertainty or not enough. And so there's something kind of interesting in that. And I think we'll probably come on and talk a little bit, hopefully, about some sort of kind of cognitive and psychological biases that humans sort of are prone to, and particularly ones that are kind of particularly sort of relevant for sports fans, Spurs fans, and anyone who likes any sport, right? But yeah, confirmation bias is a very strong one, right? And so if you're someone who's kind of got a little bit of a sort of a pet theory around, oh yeah, players always go off the boil when they sign a new contract, you'll be looking for the data, you know, not actively, not consciously, right? But this is just what our brain does. It will process the information that agrees with that theory more strongly. It will give it greater weight than the evidence against. And so it's sort of interesting to me that there's this kind of little question here, and there's sort of two almost opposing questions but coming at the same sort of topic. Of course, there's also, if you are at extreme of one end of the spectrum and at the extreme of another, I guess if someone gave out a 50-year contract, then yeah, maybe you'd go off the boil, because, you know, that is a very, very long contract. But arguably, if it's really, really one end or the other, you know, basically whenever you're dealing with extremes along a spectrum, there are probably likely to be some repercussions. But I think it's just kind of a fun little thought exercise to kind of think about, like, well, why are people coming up with these two opposing theories to explain bad performances?
So you mentioned Adam Pickering. Thank you, Adam. It was a really, really useful question. And I think, it encapsulates a lot of issues that go on in football. Uncertainty. There's so much uncertainty at clubs all the time, particularly with managerial changes. You know, managerial changes happen so frequently nowadays compared to how they used to back in the day. And at Spurs, we're experiencing sort of self-made uncertainty because of the way that Antonio Conte frames things sometimes in post-match press conferences. And obviously he does that for a reason. You know, he's trying to leverage the situation to his advantage. But is there a possibility that could have a detrimental effect on team performance?
Yeah, I mean, I think for all the same reasons that it could for the Chelsea players, like, yeah. And I guess the key difference really is potentially what's going on behind the scenes, right? And I think that's true for, you know, whenever I've come on and we've spoken about whoever the current manager is, you know, we don't know what's going on behind closed doors. So he may be sitting down all the players and saying, listen, guys, I'm I'm really here for the long haul. I really trust you guys. But, you know, we all know Daniel Levy maybe isn't, you know, the most eager to kind of go out and splash the cash. So, you know, I've got to say this to get him to change his ways or whatever, you know, like, and maybe the players are fully on board with that. They fully understand it and they therefore know not to, you know, not to really believe what he says in the interviews. If that's not what's happening, I think that could be quite confusing for those players and would lead to a bit of a sense of uncertainty that, you know, the idea that, like, he goes from, this is the worst bunch of players and they're terrible and there's a huge gulf between the quality here and the quality that I expect. And then the next week, you know, or the next game we win and he's like, this is the greatest group of players I've ever worked with. I love them all. They're like my sons. Yeah. And like the extremity in those kind of statements is likely to be a little bit confusing. That being said, it is also, and I think this is a point that I've kind of mentioned before when we were sort of referencing Mourinho, is that in Mourinho's peak, he did something sort of similar, which is at least it sort of seems like he's taking the heat off the players to some extent. And you could make that case, right? Mm-hmm. Is that after a loss, he comes out and says these extravagant things, he overreacts, he, you know, he's basically sort of ripping his clothes off and tearing out his hair, telling the world how, you know, this was the worst thing in the world. And that maybe helps draw attention away from, well, was it this player's fault, or, you know, was so-and-so just not quite up to scratch today, or was the team not quite up to scratch collectively? It kind of maybe deflects a bit of the attention away from them and brings it onto himself. So you could argue that in that sense it's helpful, but it would also, yeah, like I said, I think I would hope that behind the scenes he is expressing something quite different to the players. If he is expressing something similar to them behind the scenes, that's probably likely to be, yeah, pretty confusing and lead to a bit of a sense of like, well, how long is this guy going to be here? Is he going to be here end of the month, end of the season? Is he going to be here for 3 years? Yeah, so that's probably going to weigh on some players.
And despite his methods of deflection, there are some players that come under intense scrutiny, both online and in the ground. And those sort of confirmation biases really come into their own in the stadium, I guess, when fans are sort of seeing what they want to see and then reflecting potential negativity, which can, I guess, infect those around them. And you've experienced this yourself recently.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, this is... I just a couple of days ago, I listened to the episode quite recently with Greg Jenner and talking to the sort of data scientist, which was an outstanding episode. So if anyone's listening to this one and hasn't listened to that, it's really, really good. But there it sort of talks about the kind of the sort of online culture of abusing footballers. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because, like, the tone with which certain people communicate is kind of contagious, right? It is infectious. We are social creatures. That's kind of how we're built, how we're designed, and it runs kind of counter to our sort of intuition to not want to fit in with a crowd, with a group, right? Especially a group with whom we are kind of already bonded, right? Mm. So there's a lot of social psych theories around sort of in groups and out groups, right? So once you are all Spurs fans and you kind of have that bit of solidarity, and then you put yourself in the situation where we are all Spurs fans together at Spurs Stadium watching Spurs play, that's going to be even more sort of exacerbated, right? We're going to all kind of want to fit in. So if you then have some people starting to talk negatively, and as you mentioned, I had this happen. I was at the Wolves game, and there were some guys sat behind me, men and women who were sat behind me. And there was about a group of 10 of them, and they were sat across the two rows just behind, not their usual seats. Never encountered them before. And from the very first whistle, they were just, oh, that was terrible. Oh, that was crap. What's he doing that for? Oh, come on, can't he see he's, you know, so-and-so is free on that side? And it was just relentless. And it wasn't just one of them. It was clearly how they all communicate about football and about Spurs. Like, this was a well-worn pattern of behavior of, like, we just will pick this apart from minute one. And, you know, it was a game we went on to lose. It was quite disappointing in a lot of ways. And they were booing. They were far from the only people who were booing by the end. But they were, it was something to behold, to listen to them be so relentlessly negative from the beginning. And it certainly sort of, I mean, I guess one of my questions is, what are they getting out of this? Like, why are they doing this to themselves? Like, take up knitting or something, you know, like, but just why are you doing this to yourself? Because I can't imagine that they were really deriving very much satisfaction from what they were watching. They certainly weren't expressing that. But I think it was an interesting little sort of case study, essentially, of that group's dynamic, right? I think even if we'd gone on to win that game with a bit of a sort of a second half revival, they would have found it very hard to kind of change that narrative that's established within their group. I think they still would have been quite negative, looking to identify all of the little errors, all the rest of it, because that's just how they were operating, right? And it's quite hard to sort of turn that around. You know, it's the sort of the turning around the tanker kind of analogy. Those patterns are really established. So I think, and I guess what's interesting is, like, for those people sat around them, because they were talking very loudly and because they were across two rows, you know, they were talking to each other loudly so that they could hear themselves, and that was amplified across the group around more broadly, was what effect that had on other people, right? Mm. And I genuinely believe that our little section of the stadium was quieter, was less willing to sort of cheer and clap and sing. And we're like, it's not necessarily the loudest part of the stadium anyway, like, but it's normally you can rely on it being a little bit kind of lively, and it wasn't that day. And it's hard to know what cause and effect is here, right? Because mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. we weren't playing well, but, and so, you know, there was a little bit, there was less to be excited about. There were lots of kind of just losing 50-50s and frustrating moments and all the rest of it, and the game was sort of crying out for the sort of proverbial grab it by the scruff of the neck type moment that never really came. But still, it kind of seemed like this attitude was slightly sort of contagious, and certainly that no one wanted to be the one who started a chant or who just sort of like cheered by themselves or clapped really loudly or something, because there was this clear sense that there was this quite big group of people who didn't subscribe to that kind of concept. And I think that can then happen more broadly, right? And I think social media is very bad for this, like in terms of, you know, amplifying extreme opinions potentially on both ends of the spectrum, mm-hmm. but, you know, it, and sort of deadening those in the middle who just have a sort of a bit more of a kind of like, yeah, we lost, but it wasn't the end of the world kind of viewpoint that doesn't get likes. But also just that, you know, I think even within a stadium, once you start having that atmosphere, once you have some people start booing, it just puts that idea in your head of, oh, well, they're booing, they must be booing for a reason. And particularly in that kind of instance where with booing or with very vocal negative sort of comments, like the only, or certainly for booing, the sort of the counterpoint to that often is just silence, right? Which isn't a very strong endorsement necessarily, right? But it would be quite adversarial if, like, a group of people started booing and the other lot kind of immediately started, you know, come on, you Spurs, or whatever, right? As a, like, then you've almost got sort of rival factions within a group. And like I said, with social creatures, that kind of runs counter to what we are intuitively want to do. So yeah, it's just a sort of an interesting experience of kind of seeing some of this sort of like the sort of social dynamics kind of at play within a football stadium, within football supporting group, as it sort of like played out live. And I it definitely affected me. I really, really did not enjoy that game. And I, it was, I mean, it was a hard game to enjoy, but it was a really negative experience for me to sort of sit there and have them behind me the whole time just criticizing.
I mean, that's basically the definition of toxic behavior, isn't it? It's allowing your own negative opinions to ruin someone else's day.
Yeah.
And perhaps not deliberately. You know, I'm sure these people were probably just going about their fandom in the way they always do, and they don't realize that they're doing that. And no, I'm not going to pretend that I'm above that, because, I mean, firstly, our podcast fairly regularly receives criticism for being relentlessly positive, which I don't think is quite true. But, you know, certainly there's a group of fans that definitely think we're overly positive about Spurs, and certainly that I am in particular. But when Jose Mourinho is our manager, I absolutely felt myself getting dragged into a negative spiral. I mean, I really tried to give him a chance, and once I'd realised I can't see this going anywhere good, it was like every little thing that went wrong was absolutely his fault, and he was the only one to blame. And so I was falling foul of this myself, and I recognise it now. And it must have been quite annoying to listen to for people when they were listening to our podcast during that period. And I'm sure there were many other people that felt the same way, because he does have that kind of dementor effect of sucking the goodness out of a situation. He makes it all about him. And when it's all about him and it's not going well, it's not much fun. But yeah, I mean, I absolutely get it. I just don't think doesn't feel like the right time to be like that. I mean, we're still in with a chance of top four, certainly at the time that match was going on. We weren't in a bad position at all. Perhaps it was the fact that it followed the Southampton match, where we'd been taken apart quite dramatically by a team who will probably finish in the mid-table. Perhaps that's got a lot to do with it, but
yeah,
it doesn't help what's happening on the pitch, does it?
No, and I think, you know, coming back to, well, so I think often, well, so sort of talking about sort of like the way that our brains are kind of wired, like we do tend to overemphasize sort of negative experiences or incidents over positive ones, right? And from a sort of an evolutionary perspective, that kind of makes sense, right? Like if you're the sort of caveman or cavewoman wandering through the forest, right? And there's a patch of forest that's got some like decent berries, and there's a patch of forest that's got a tiger living in it. Like your brain is much better off paying attention to which is the bit of the forest with the tiger in, right? Like you can survive without berries for a little bit, you know, for a day or two. Mm-hmm. You can't survive if you get eaten by the tiger. So our brains are kind of hardwired around that. There's also just a bit of a sort of, you know, we have developed emotional sort of coping mechanisms, I guess, to sort of try and protect ourselves. And if from the first minute you go, Spurs are rubbish, Spurs are going to lose this, look how bad they're playing, oh, they can't, you know, that was dreadful, then if we go on to lose, which in that case we did, you at least have a little bit of a told you so type moment. Whereas if you're like, no, I've actually got a good feeling about this, there's kind of nowhere but down from that, right? Like if you win, it's like, oh, cool, but that's all I was expecting. And if you don't, then on a personal level, there will be potentially more disappointment, but also conceivably a little bit if you have told people about it. Mm-hmm. You feel embarrassed because they turn around and go, yeah, you thought you were going to win that against Wolves, but you didn't. And, you know, so that then starts to come into play. So that some of these are understandable, right, as mechanisms for doing that. And similarly, I think there's kind of, you know, when we're talking about confirmation bias, there's also other elements to this as well, right? Which is, you know, these, you know, particularly I think, or increasingly sports journalism and football journalism, I guess, even more so, love to generate narratives, right? Narratives sell papers, get clicks, get viewers, because you can then, oh, maybe, you know, any time that something fits the narrative, you already have a starting point. Anytime something slightly falls outside of that, that's a talking point. But these narratives tend to be very reductionist, right, in terms of what you're actually dealing with, and they often overlook just sort of reasonably basic fundamental points about how a football season is going to go, right? Like there's a reason why, and you know, I can't believe I'm bringing them up, but you know, Arsenal's Invincibles team, it is exceptional because they're the only team who's gone an entire Premier League season without losing, right? So if Spurs lose a match, one match, two matches, that is not really news, right? That's just how a season goes for every football team pretty much forever, right? Like, but that's not a story. So what you have to do is you have to say, well, does that loss fit a narrative or counter a narrative? And then you say to, you know, Roy Keane, oh, I think this fits the narrative. And he goes, no, it doesn't fit the narrative, and is paid to be grumpy. And then Micah jumps in and goes, no, I think it does, or whatever, you know. And like, then you've got your little sparring, and that's how you fill the half an hour between one match and the next. But those narratives can be incredibly powerful because they give you the sort of the framework into which your confirmation bias can then easily slot, right? So if you are given a narrative that Spurs are Spursy, right, that we throw things away at the, you know, at crucial moments, then you are looking for instances of that, and they will only confirm that, and you're more likely to then overlook the instances, like our run to the Champions League final, right, where we had two successive rounds where we pulled off like the unspursiest results ever, right? Against City and Ajax. Those were the absolute antithesis of spursiness, like pulling off unbelievable results against all odds by showing some real resilience and fight back. And yet that's never really touched upon, right? Like that doesn't fit the narrative. So in the moment, maybe it's like, oh, is this the new dawn for Tottenham? Is Pochettino going to do it? But all that's doing is really hyping up a sense of expectation, so that if we don't meet that narrative, then we go, ah, no, it was all for nothing. They are still Spursy. So it's just really interesting that to me, that feels like a sort of a premise within, and as just a sort of an accepted way that sports journalism is kind of conducted. That allows people to then very neatly fit their own confirmation biases in and around that. And certainly that you can then find a sports journalist somewhere who will agree with your particular bias and back you up on it, right? And so, you know, whether you believe that Daniel Levy is the worst manager in the, you know, in football history, you can go out and find, you know, some journalists and hundreds of Twitter accounts that support you, and then you're in your own little echo chamber, and you found your in-group who believe you and subscribe to the same ideas, and you just sort of bounce off each other feeling more and more negative towards Daniel Levy. Or maybe it's not Daniel Levy, it's Harry Winks, or maybe it's not Harry Winks, it's Dele Alli, or maybe it's not Dele Alli, it's whoever. And yeah, then you're caught in this sort of like, you're not only confirming your own biases, but you're having them confirmed for you by others.
It's really fascinating, and you've managed a nice segue by talking about sports journalism, because we've got a question from Stuart about media training, which I think fits in quite nicely here.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
So Stuart says, how do you think professional football players feel about media training? Watching interviews with players, it can often feel unnatural, as players seem to have been trained to give standardised answers to questions. Do you think the players would benefit from being trusted more by football clubs to vocalise their own answers in response to questions from the football media?
Yeah, this was a really interesting question. And to be honest, I'd never really thought about it from this angle. So my wife is also a sports psychologist, so I actually spoke to her about this as well. So she's a Spurs fan as well, and we were like, well, what do you think? And her take was very similar to mine, which is that probably the answer is, actually, I suspect most of them are really glad to have it, that actually, you know, increasingly, you know, and especially with social media, right, saying even the slightest little thing wrong can lead to such a backlash, such a sort of, you know, pile on, whatever, that having been trained, knowing what the stock answers are, gives you that fallback to just sort of like know, I'll just sort of say like, yeah, the lads did great. We're on, you know, we're just thinking about the next game, one game at a time. Gaffer told us, you know, that you know, whatever. And you just kind of batted away with some sort of tedious, well-rehearsed answers. But I suspect that's probably really, really sort of appreciated, I guess, by the football players, right? And I think it's sort of worth bearing in mind that, you know, like, it's always worth bearing in mind that footballers are humans at the end of the day. And that, you know, for vast swathes of the population, talking in public is like one of the most stressful things to do, right? Even if that is just talking in front of like a handful of colleagues, like that can be overwhelming to a good number of people. And actually there is a psychology test, right? So one of the ways that they want, if you want to authentically induce stress in an individual so that you can either test their stress levels or test what they do under stress. And it's called the TRIA stress test. And it involves talking to a group of people. So what they do is they set you up in a room, and apologies to any psychology researchers who are hoping to call on Spurs fans because I'm about to give the game away. But what they will do is they'll say like, okay, cool, we're going to call you over. And then we'll give you like a minute to think of a topic. And then you walk in and they say you have to talk unbroken for a minute. And they've got people there in white coats and they've got a camera set up and all the rest of it so that it feels very formal, feels very official. And they ask you just to talk without stopping for a minute on a chosen subject. And the panel are not meant to respond at all. They're meant to sit there very stony faced. If you run out of time or run out of things to say, they will just go, you still have 30 seconds. Please continue talking.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that is a way of inducing stress. And it is such a well-known and universal experience that that would cause stress that it's used frequently for across all sort of subsets of psychology. So the idea that you sort of call in a footballer who's also, you know, minutes after full time, right, potentially. So they're sort of like partly out of breath. They want to go and just warm down, refuel, put some clothes on, just get home, right? And you kind of call them over and you go, what did you think about that? I suspect that having something that's just totally inoffensive is quite a sort of quite a relief at that point. And I guess the other sort of part of that is conversely, like, I think there's, you know, there are players who are kind of known to be a bit more quirky or authentic in their interviews. They sort of, if they feel confident doing that, they can. So I think there's also a bit of a sort of counterfactual there around, like, if you really want to, if you really want to break away from the sort of press training, you can. And actually, that, you know, there are some examples of people who've done that to really quite extreme extents and haven't necessarily been sort of punished that hard, right? So it's not like there's a real sort of crackdown from a club that, like, oh, you said this, you said that, right? So, you know, Danny Rose came out and gave that interview. It wasn't like the club turned around and like terminated his contract, right? They were like, okay, well, you're still our player. He didn't play very much after that, but that was also partly form, whatever, you know, changes as manager, Mourinho, et cetera, right? There's a number of different reasons there. You guys have spoken previously about Lucas Moura and his political beliefs, right? It's not like the club has cracked down on him for that, which is, in my opinion, a genuine shame and bordering on a disgrace that they haven't, because he is a very vocal supporter of some things that I don't think he should be supporting that the club say they stand against, right? Gattuso was touted as our manager, despite everything he has said and done and whatever, and is on record saying. So people can go off script, and it's not like they are then cast into the wilderness, right? So there is, you know, there is a sense there, I guess, that actually, to be honest, if you are a player and you really want to speak your mind, you probably can. And actually, you're probably going to get away with it. And therefore, I think that the frequency with which you see people just, players just spouting, yeah, the sort of same slightly tedious responses is probably just a sign that, you know, they are not barristers, they're not politicians, they're paid to play football, and the post-match interview is probably the thing they dread most about their job.
It is really weird how the sort of post-match interview has become its own little industry, isn't it? How, you know, the players are trotted out and they say the same old things, talked to them by specialists in PR, I suspect. And then the pundits analyse the same old things the players have said week after week in a really unexciting way. And we know what's going to come. We know exactly what they're going to say every time, pretty much. There's nothing new. And yet it continues. It's quite bizarre when you sort of stand back and reflect on that. But English football, it takes a while to move forward, I suppose. So that's probably why we still continue with this little game of cat and mouse, occasionally trying to catch someone out, I guess. I do remember last season James Maddison gave an interview which was very off script, and he got lots of plaudits for it. I think he's quite a questionable character, Maddison, and he said some things that are less impressive. But on one occasion, I remember watching him thinking, wow, yeah, that was brave. That was authentic. That felt like the barriers were down. He was just being himself and he was being honest. And if I were a Leicester fan, I'd have loved to have seen it. And I'd have been quite open to it. And yeah, he got a lot of positive comments. But there you go. I've just said, I think he's a questionable character. So it works both ways, right? I think you're right. I think the comfort blanket is probably quite helpful.
Yeah, and obviously it then sort of becomes a bit of a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy or whatever, because once you've got the majority of players relying on these pretty standard answers, the one player who does break from that stands out even more, right? So we'll come in for even more press attention, even more attention online, all the rest of it, right? Because everyone else is just saying the same trite stuff about, yeah, on to the next game, whatever. So you stand out even more. And so as that kind of continues, right, like you go from 75% of players don't want to speak out to 80% to 85% to 90% to 95%, right? And now you're at 99% of players never say anything other than just the same boring answer. But that's because you're going to be even kind of weirder, quote unquote, even more exceptional, even more press worthy if you do come out and go, I'm tearing up the script and here's how I really feel.
Yeah. And I don't know if you heard about what happened with Marcus Rashford this week. So Marcus Rashford, obviously someone who has been universally loved by pretty much all football fans because he's done so many good things and he's spoken out really eloquently and strongly against, I mean, in favour of young people, essentially. I mean, and who can argue with that? It seems like, you know, that is a good thing, and he's been lauded for it correctly. And he had an altercation with some fans outside a match. Post match, he got some criticism, a barrage of criticism, and he said to someone, "Why don't you come here and say it to my face?" or something along those lines. Maybe it was a kind of, "I bet you wouldn't come here and say it to my face," rather than being directly confrontational. And he got loads of criticism from United fans. You know, even the most well-loved players who have seen to sort of be universally net good, it can change in an instant for them. So no wonder they keep their thoughts themselves. I mean, look at Dele. Basically, he used to have fun on social media. He used to be sort of playful. And the amount of times I've seen people say, he needs to stick to football and stop playing Fortnite. And I'm just like, seriously? Like, he's just allowing a bit of his character and some of his hobbies to come through in his social media presence. And he's getting criticized for that.
But then he made that inappropriate joke, right? And
true.
You know, so yes, you're completely right. Like, which was undeniably inappropriate. I think probably was not intended to be offensive, you know, but nonetheless, it was what it was. But you know, that's then the risk you take, right? You show a bit more authenticity, you just run the risk that you just say the wrong thing, you do the wrong thing, and then there's a pylon, right? Whether that's justified or not, right? And in that case, I think, you know, the outrage was probably, you know, more justified certainly than it is against Marcus Rashford. I mean, it's also astonishing. I mean, Marcus Rashford has come through the Man United Academy. Yeah. Like, he is a childhood fan of the club and all the rest of it. Like, he couldn't be more Man United if he tried. And is also a stand-up character. So the idea that, you know, but again, we're just back to this kind of concept that, yeah, footballers are human, but we are not very good at remembering that as a general rule. And so we expect them to be perfectly well-behaved at all times.
So I've got a very detailed question here, and you might have to really explain this in layman's terms. So this is from Solipsistic Spurs, who says, I would be curious to hear Alex's thoughts on the intersection of psychopathology and performance. For example, how often when working with a performance client does psychopathology appear? Many interventions I practice with clients in forensic psychology also seem to be used in performance consultation, at least in my limited understanding of the field. Very excited to hear your response.
Yeah, a very cool question. And one, I guess, more for the maybe for the sort of psychology geeks who may be listening. So I guess it can and does happen for sure that you're sort of talking to someone. It depends a little bit what exactly you kind of mean by psychopathology. Certainly, I guess the first thing to say is that, you know, so I have a certain kind of point at which my competence as a sports psychologist sort of ceases. So if someone in the course of the sessions working with me, it becomes very clear that there is, you know, a diagnosable mental illness, whether that be sort of severe depression, whether it's something more like sort of bipolar, or whether it's kind of eating disorders, anything along those lines, it basically moves beyond my realm of being able to help. There are specific ways and you need to be trained in those. So at that point, I would normally look to refer them on to someone who knows more. Now, it's possible that I may continue working with them and I would then become part of a team. So I may then be kind of collaborating with that. Normally that would then be a clinical psychologist or potentially a counseling psychologist. And so I may sort of continue to work with them as a way of sort of giving the sort of sporting insight, particularly if the other psychologist doesn't come from a sporting background, maybe doesn't necessarily understand what sport means to a sort of a competitive sports person. But in general, I mean, that's extremely rare that happens. If there are sort of other elements of that, and I guess this is, you know, where it kind of depends what you mean exactly by psychopathology, but, you know, there are certainly sort of, I guess, kind of character traits and characteristics that I see come up a lot in people that I'm talking to that can be helpful or unhelpful. So, you know, or that maybe, again, as we were sort of talking about earlier with spectrums, you know, people who are very much at one end of a spectrum at an extreme, it generally, you know, being at an extreme is generally, you know, not a good thing. So a kind of bit of sort of moderation. So, you know, when I talk with people who are extremely perfectionistic, right? Perfectionism is often, you would kind of imagine, is a really good thing for an elite sports person because it's going to drive them to continue being better and better and better. Ultimately, it can become problematic right at the very extreme end of that, because if you aren't, because it is unreasonable and unrealistic to expect yourself to be perfect all of the time, or in fact very often, right? Perfect is unachievable generally. So if you are someone who is so driven by perfectionism that you can't essentially get out of your own head about it, and it then becomes frustrating and demotivating and demoralizing, then it can become problematic. So you can have people who do that. There are other sort of, you know, I have done training courses on using sort of psychological kind of theories and techniques. So I've done ones on CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, and I've done one on ACT, which is acceptance and commitment therapy. And I use those a little more for those who know the difference. I'm a little more inclined towards ACT generally, but I use elements of those in my practice as well. So very often, you know, I will, you know, the things that maybe impact people in more extreme ways that can lead to depression or sort of some form of sort of, yeah, just sort of an unhelpful psychological kind of state. Some of those sort of same things will crop up that are impacting their sporting performance, of course, right? Because, you know, the two are going to be intrinsically linked, the person and the sports person. And so they may be having to sort of adjust or try and work with them on some of that, right? And very often you will find that, well, so I probably should have said this right at the beginning of the answer, sorry, is that it also depends a bit how much time I have with the client. So very often if I'm working with an organization, they may say you've got 4 sessions or 6 sessions, in which case it's relatively short. I will focus very much just on their performance, and anything that sort of starts bubbling up that's clearly more of an underlying issue would broadly be sort of unethical and unhelpful to sort of open a can of worms that I don't have time to then properly clean up, as it were. So yeah, in those instances I will try and keep it very focused. If it's a client who I have sort of an unlimited number of sessions with, who I'm seeing, then potentially we will get into some of those sort of deeper questions about, like, well, why, you know, if they constantly feel like they're a failure, or they're not living up to expectations, or they're a bit too perfectionistic, or whatever it happens to be, then we might try and dig a little deeper into, like, where that comes from, and are there other areas of their life where that's also presenting? If there are, why is that? If they're not, that's also really interesting. Well, how come it's only showing up in your sport but not in your work, or not in your personal relationships or whatever?
It's really interesting. I'm just thinking, are there examples where someone with a mental health condition can improve their condition through sports psychology? I mean, obviously it's not a replacement for be it therapy or medication or whatever, but do you think that sports psychology can have a role in improving people's mental health?
Yeah, and for sure. And I think, I mean, there is a lot of evidence to suggest that exercise is an incredibly, or is an effective tool for reducing sort of mild and moderate depression, mild and moderate anxiety, and a host of other things. Getting outside, getting some sunshine, you know, green therapy and things like that, of just sort of being in an outdoors space, seeing some greenery is really helpful as well. And obviously that can sometimes go together. So yeah, I think there's a lot on that. I mean, technically my master's, my training is as both a sport and exercise psychologist. So the exercise side of things isn't a big part of what I do, but there are people who have gone through the same training process as me who work with individuals who are trying to, whether it's sort of they've been diagnosed with diabetes or they're pre-diabetic or something and they need a fitness regime, but they're struggling for motivation, those kinds of things. But also who may be working more along those lines that I just sort of spoke about there, of sort of, yeah, trying to get someone who's not their best self, right? Who's struggling a little bit with something, and finding, yeah, exercise plans, exercise regimes that will fit with them and help them sort of feel better about themselves that way. So yeah, it can certainly be helpful. I think it's, my understanding of the evidence is it's more at the sort of moderate and mild end of the spectrum. I think by the time you've got into sort of really severe depression, really severe anxiety, and some of the sort of more severe sort of diagnosable mental illness, sort of that's trickier, and sport can be a problem. Sport is less helpful there. It hasn't been proven to be as effective there.
Hence you would be making those referrals. Yeah, and just another follow-up on that, people have got much better about talking about their mental health. Have you found, and this might be one from sort of your wife's viewpoint because she's been doing it a little longer than you, have you found that people are more open and willing as you've been going on with your practice?
That's a really interesting question. I think it probably is changing, but I do think there's still a surprising amount of reluctance. I think some people still don't necessarily, part of it is that people maybe don't really know what a sports psychologist is or does. I think that can be a huge part of it. So I think one aspect of sports psychology that often gets overlooked, and I'm probably also guilty of not sort of advertising this, when I talk to organizations, is sports psychology tends to be thought of as a way of sort of, oh, I have a problem, right? I am unmotivated, or I can't perform under pressure. Get me back to a baseline, right? So there's there's that sort of side of things. But there is also an additive bit of sports psychology, which is I'm currently at this baseline. Can sports psychology make me even better? And that's an area where I think, you know, it can be really, really cool, really interesting. It's a slightly different way of approaching things. And obviously it's a slightly different client base that you'd be working with there. People who are trying to make those, you know, make the fine margins count, right? Make the little tiny incremental differences. But that's definitely something that can be looked at within sports psychology that I think is often a sort of overlooked element of the work. And I think that therefore kind of means that because people don't necessarily know that, they don't necessarily come to sports psychologists about that. It tends to be more sort of problem driven of like, oh, I used to be able to do X, but now I feel like Y, or, you know, help fix me. So that I think is still quite a widespread phenomenon. And I think it also depends a little bit. I think, you know, without totally resorting to stereotypes, I think there are still differences between the willingness of sort of men versus women, of, you know, younger people versus older people. Not exclusively, you know, I work with a male in his sort of, I think, late 40s, early 50s, who came to me voluntarily and is incredibly open and is perfectly willing to share, and who sought me out of his own accord. So, you know, it is not a hard and fast rule. It's not just sort of 14-year-old girls who are like, oh, I'll talk to the sports psychologist. And some of the 14-year-old girls are very reluctant to do so, you know. So it's totally, you know, there is a mixed bag, but I think it probably is changing, but it's quite slow.
Mm. Really fascinating. I've got one more question for you before you go, Alex, and this is from Yagnesh Vadgama, who says, what are your recommendations for athletes when they hit that proverbial wall, more so on the mental health blocks that athletes sometimes find themselves in? Hitting the wall, is this something that you're asked about regularly?
Yeah, and I guess it sort of depends a little bit if we're talking, you know, runners, long distance runners sort of talk about hitting a wall in terms, you know, like in a marathon or whatever. So I don't know if this is if the question is about a sort of specific moment, like a much more kind of shorter time frame of like, what do you do in that moment? What can you do to push through the pain or whatever it takes then, or whether it's a slightly longer term thing. So if you don't mind, I'll try and have a crack at both. So, and they'll probably kind of tie together a bit. I guess at the core of both of them, whether you're thinking short term or long term, is it's always helpful to have a really clear idea of what your goals are. Right. And I suspect we've probably spoken about kind of clear goal setting before, and having, I think we've spoken about the difference between an outcome goal, which is your kind of long-term like dream. That's the sort of like kissing the cup or biting the medal moment or standing on the podium, whatever it happens to be. And then you break that down. And so you have your process goals on a day-to-day basis. So if you're talking more about the sort of the longer term hitting a wall of just sort of feeling a bit demotivated, feeling a bit burnt out, tying what you're doing every day to that goal can be really powerful just in and of itself, of reminding yourself essentially like, oh, the alarm clock's going off really early tomorrow because I've got to go training. Oh, that sounds grim. I don't want to do it. If you can take a small segment of, but think how happy I'll feel when I'm stood on that podium or whatever, you can kind of use that to rejuvenate yourself, to energize yourself. So that can be really helpful. Motivation and success are very closely interlinked. So if you start feeling that motivation and then you then really celebrate the successes that come with that, that can be really helpful as well. So like, okay, I don't want the alarm clock to go off tomorrow at 5:30 a.m., but it's gonna. And then after that session, you go, God, I was really dreading that session, but I did it. And actually, when I turned up, I worked on this process goal, whether it's, you know, like this element of my technique or this element of my stamina. I'm going to, you know, I don't need to like throw a party or anything, but I am going to reflect on that. And very often I work with clients, I'll say like, whatever it is, after a training session or whatever, you just grab a post-it, write down a couple of things that you're proud of. If you want, you can just throw that post-it away, but just taking that moment to write them down gives your brain that little hit of satisfaction. It's like, cool, yeah, that was worth it. The alarm clock went off, I went, I trained hard, and I'm proud of this, that, and the other. Or keep those post-its, put them in a little jam jar so that you've got like a little stockpile of evidence as you go forward. That's quite nice, because then when you're setting the alarm the next time around, you've got this little kind of reminder of like, oh, no, this is worth it, because every time that alarm clock goes off, I get to put another post-it in the jar or whatever. And that can sound really like basic and almost childish, but it can be really, really powerful. And there's a number of different ways of kind of doing that. So that, I guess, is the sort of the more the kind of that longer term thing. Another option can be just like evaluating your alternatives, right? So again, earlier I was sort of talking about the sort of emotional coping mechanisms, like a voice that pops up and says like, "Ooh, Spurs are going to lose this," like, you know, or you'll be disappointed if Spurs lose, so just say that's what you expect all the way along. Well, that same voice can kind of kick in either in a longer term basis of like, maybe we should pack this in, maybe you're never going to achieve that goal, or in a race, oh God, this really hurts, maybe I'm not going to make it to the finish line. If you can sort of take that voice and you can essentially sort of either characterize it and sort of maybe even name it as like, oh yeah, that's the doubtful voice, or you name its story, the narrative that it is telling you around sort of like, oh, well, you're going to quit, right? So that's the quit narrative, or the you're never going to make it narrative, the failure narrative or whatever. And then you go like, yeah, I've heard this before. You go on and on about this. I've heard that narrative, but right now I'm halfway through a marathon. You are not a helpful voice to be having right now. So I'm going to just sort of try and essentially sort of turn the volume down on you. That can be really helpful. And also then around that sort of same sense of like having that kind of that protection, right? That protection wants to kick in and say like, oh God, this is going really badly. You're in loads of pain. You should, you know, well, what are your alternatives? Let's say you're 2/3 of a way through a marathon. I mean, no one's making you do it. You could just stop, right? You could just walk over to the side, just walk off the course. Is that actually better? Well, maybe, right? But probably not, right? Because you've presumably spent months training for it. You've maybe spent, you know, if it's something like the London Marathon, you may have had to apply 2 or 3 years in a row. You've maybe raised loads of money for charity. You've got all these different things that are sort of saying like, actually, it's probably worth just pushing through this pain and getting to the end of it. Because then at least, because you're in pain either way right now, right? So you might as well finish it and get that buzz of satisfaction and also pay the money to charity and blah, 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 rather than the alternative. And so sometimes just having that in mind can be really helpful as well, for just like, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to push through this. And then also just any sense of evidence that you have. So if you've done marathons before and you know that they always hurt at a certain point, when you come up on that point and it starts to hurt again, you go, yeah, but I know I can push through this pain because I've got photos of me at the finish line in 2018, 2019, 2020 and 21. You know, here I am this year, I will finish because I know that I can. So having that as well can just be really helpful.
Well, I never. Bardi's got his free marathon advice here. I was not expecting that. Amazing.
You can cut that out then.
No, I wouldn't do that to him. As ever, really fascinating. What tends to happen is people will then send in a bunch of questions. Please do that, because we'll definitely speak to Alex again in the future. So if anything cropped up whilst you listen to this that you'd like a follow-up on, drop us an email and I'll save the question and I'll put it to Alex when we next speak. Because this stuff is gold. It's so interesting. It's, you know, and this is, you know, in that space where the pundits are speaking to footballers about the same old things after football matches and then analysing the same old things, they could be having this kind of stuff in there. It would be great to have a sports psychologist and a football gantry speaking about the impact that has on performance. But no, so we're forced we're forced to dig deeper in our little corner of the internet. Alex, it's absolutely brilliant to speak to you. Where can people find you? And, you know, if there's anyone listening who might want to hire you, how would they do that?
So best bet, if it's a sort of inquiry potentially about some work, is to find me through the consultancy that I work for, which is Optimize Potential. And the website for that is optimizepotentialsport.com. Or you can find me, I'm on Instagram and Twitter. Twitter as Alex Stoyel, which is S-T-O-Y-E-L. Often people put it L-E, but it's E-L. And yeah, if you just sort of search for me on any of the social media platforms, I will pop up there. Also LinkedIn, I guess.
Awesome. And I'm sure we'll speak again soon.
Lovely. Thanks very much for having me. Always a pleasure.
And just a reminder that we are once again partnered with Pleatees for March, casual wear for fully coys people. Pleatees.com is their website, pleatees.com, and use the code EXTRA20 to get 20% off.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud, E. Lindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.